Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Alan Winter, co-author of The Sins of the Father. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are approaching the Freedom Festival, the great holiday of Passover, now less than 2 weeks away, which means this coming Sabbath is called Shabbat HaGadol, literally the great Sabbath preceding Passover. Pesach is perhaps the most observed of all Jewish holidays, and it is certainly ideologically central to Judaism. The Exodus from Egypt and the theme of liberation from oppression is at the heart of our Jewish understanding of how the world should be, and it has inspired countless movements for freedom around the world and throughout history. The Sabbath before Passover is also a big Shabbat because it marks a time of preparation for a holiday that requires lots and lots of getting ready, removing the leavening from our homes, doing a thorough spring cleaning, and then cooking and prepping all the food for the Seder and the week of Passover. So a Shabbat HaGadol indeed, a big Sabbath in every way. However, the name for this coming Friday and Saturday comes not solely because it's the Shabbat prior to Pesach, but from the words of a special Haftarah, the selection from the prophets chanted during the Torah service. This prophecy comes from a man named Malachi, who is known as the final prophet in Jewish tradition, the last prophet, author of the last book of the middle section of the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, the Nevi'im. According to Judaism, Malachi, that means servant, it might be a description of his function rather than his actual name, was the very last person to receive direct communication from God, telling him to talk to the Jews. Malachi lived in the 5th century BCE, about 2,400 years ago, when the temple in Jerusalem had been rebuilt after its earlier destruction. But religious motivation among the Israelites was waning. As Rabbi Gunther Plaut puts it in his commentary, Malachi describes a priesthood forgetful of its duties, a temple that is underfunded because the people have lost interest, a society in which Jewish men divorce their Jewish wives to marry out of the faith. In other words, a time in some ways much like our own. In the special Haftorah chanted on this great Shabbat, Malachi seeks to inspire the people of Israel to return to God and worship, to connect again with their powerful ancient tradition. Malachi tells them, "For you who revere my name, a son of righteousness will rise with healing on its wings. Remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, the ritual and practical laws I commanded him at Mount Horeb for all Israel." And then the prophet concludes, "Here, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord, to turn the hearts of parents to their children and the hearts of children to their parents." In ritual tradition, part of that sentence is repeated, "The coming of the great and awesome day of God, HaGadol VeHanora." You know, I've always appreciated Malachi's words. There will come a time when God sends Elijah the prophet to turn the hearts of parents to children and the hearts of children to parents, to bridge the great generation gaps and unite us across all that might otherwise divide us. Elijah, of course, figures very prominently in the Passover Seder itself, theoretically visiting every table and drinking from the cup set aside solely for him. It's a beautiful, mystical moment in the later stages of the evening of Pesach, a time when we indeed can feel the closeness of reunited family at Passover. Perhaps because this year, for the first time in many, my own 3 children will be together at my own Seder table, along with my wife and my father, well, Malachi's words ring especially true for me today. May we all be so blessed at Pesach this year. To play us in this morning on that theme, here's a play-in from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music, Ki Lo Na'eh, from the concluding songs of the Seder. This is Moshe Oysher's great upbeat Ki Lo Na'eh, as sung by cantor Shulam Lemmer.
Who are the Shimama will look for Kila no Kila you are?
Kilo in the way, Kilo you are, 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 Kilo in the way,
Kilo in the way, Kilo you are,
Kilo you are, Kilo in the way,
Kilo in the way, Kilo you are,
Kilo you are.
That was Ki Lo Na'eh by Moshe Oysher, sung by Shulam Lemmer, for the Passover Seder, coming up a little less than 2 weeks from now, April 15th. Join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for our second night community Seder, Saturday night, April 16th. Our theme is Freedom with an Outstretched Hand, focusing on helping refugees and Ukrainian Jews on this great festival of freedom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Alan Winter, author of the thriller The Sins of the Fathers, a dramatic new adventure novel set in Israel and elsewhere. Meet him when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Alan Winter is the co-author of the new novel, Sins of the Fathers, a fascinating book. We'll talk about it quite a bit. He's also the co-author of Wolf, a novel, and four other novels, including Savior's Day. Winter graduated from Rutgers and has professional degrees from both NYU and Columbia. He was an associate professor there for some years, edited an award-winning journal, has published a lot of articles. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Sins of the Fathers takes a very different take on a very dark figure. Tell us how you came to decide to approach it this way.
We found we didn't do selected. This topic almost selected us in the sense that we found when researching the origins of Hitler and the Nazis that historians really clouded over a lot of truths, perpetuated a lot of myths, and our research led us to places that are not comfortable, perhaps, but we feel are truthful.
You know, when you're talking about a figure like Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shmo, as we say, may his name be erased, he's always demonized as like the worst human being that ever existed. Not a bad take, but that's not how he came across to the people that he was interacting. That's not the whole story.
No, that's correct. I mean, he should be demonized. I mean, let me be clear about this. He was probably the worst villain of the 20th century, if not of all time. So I want that to be clear. But he took over Germany that was absolutely reeling from the terms of the Versailles Treaty. Germany was a hungry country. The caloric intake was low. People were unemployed. They were devastated by the depression, the worldwide depression. And he gave them jobs. He put them back to work. He put food back in their mouths. And so in the early years, they sacrificed the fact that they lost some liberties, but he made their lives better.
He was also, it's a great little, trick. You say, who would you like to be your leader? Somebody who smokes cigars all the time, gets drunk every single night, sometimes does work from the bathtub, is utterly arrogant and completely sexist. Would you like the second guy who drinks martinis every night, cheats on his wife with a variety of women, certainly one prominently, comes from a super aristocratic background? Or do you want a guy who was a war hero, a vegetarian, who loved dogs, who was a complete teetotaler and a workaholic? Which one of those three would you like as your leader?
Oh, it sounds like the last one, which is the description of Hitler.
Exactly. And the first two are Churchill and Roosevelt. So,
right.
I mean, it's just kind of like that comes out in Sins of the Fuzz. It came out in your first book, of course, too. We will continue this conversation with Alan Winter. The new book is called Sins of the Fathers, a really interesting novel about Hitler. And we will return in just a moment and talk some more here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night or Saturday morning or both, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary safely, but in person. 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our temple is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Choya, near the entrance of the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. In-person Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning services are at 10 a.m. Or join us on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, where you can find our services with full music. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website or emailing me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, too, some students live and some on Zoom. Join us for Passover this year, freedom with an outstretched hand. We celebrate the magnificent Second Night Community Seder at Beit Simcha, Saturday, April 16th, 6:30 p.m., led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. A full and delicious Passover meal, a powerful affirmation of freedom and hope in this season of Pesach. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. 276-5675. You can also donate to Ukrainian Refugee Relief as you sign up for our Second Night Seder. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetcher Kfel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, 2JewishRadio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean, and you know what? Leave a good review while you're at it. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are now pleased and serene to bring you an occasional feature of Two Jewish Haikus for Jews from our Zen Judaism department. We opened the door for Elijah the prophet. Now our cat is gone. That was our Zen Judaism Haiku for Jews for the coming festival of Passover, less than 2 weeks away. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We are approaching Pesach, Passover, and you can call the Seder the history feast. I've heard it called that. It's not wrong, in which we spend a lot of time remembering not only the history of slavery and Exodus, but the whole history of our people is encapsulated in parts of the Seder and various parts of the Seder. We think a lot about history as Jews. We have it as a central part of who we are, what our past was. But history isn't, for many people, anything solid at all. It's fluid. Interpretations change. That can be a challenge if you don't evolve. And Judaism has always kind of reintegrated history as it goes along. But I don't know. It's just an interesting topic this time of year, particularly.
Absolutely. You know, first of all, we're living in an era when history seems more fungible. We have cancel culture. We rewrite stuff. We reinterpret it.
We argue about facts, for that matter.
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily remain the same as it was when we were 8 years old in grade school. But Jewish history is another matter. And, you know, what you said about Passover is absolutely true. It's like a history feast. In some sense, every Jewish holiday is the same. They attacked us. With God's help, we defeated them. Now let's eat. So you could sum up the Passover Seder that way, but you wouldn't be doing it justice because more than any other holiday, we review and recite in a fairly repetitive manner the events of the Exodus from Egypt.
You can make a case that it's the central story of Judaism, something that
happened, if it happened historically at all, 3,250 years ago or thereabouts. And yet it's in so much of Jewish tradition. And when we do the Kiddush on Friday night, we say it's Zecher Letzion Mitzrayim. It's a remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt.
And we also say, or actually Torah says frequently, Ki Gerim Hayitem Be'eretz Mitzrayim, which is the overarching reason.
You were strangers in the land of Egypt. Remember the stranger. Treat the refugee well.
This is why we are so impelled as a people, and always have been, to take care of refugees and immigrants and the dispossessed, because the have-nots was our team always.
So that's certainly the case. As we move towards Passover, I own a collection of Haggadot, different Haggadahs, the book with which we tell the Passover experience at the Seder. I might have 100 of different ones, edited one myself, and they all reflect some differences in emphasis and storytelling and focus. The way we look at history does change.
Well, I would say yes and no. The way we look at history as secular people changes when we find new evidence, whether documentary or artifacts. We find shards of pottery that cause us to rethink a whole period of ancient civilization. But our beliefs about the events of the Exodus from Egypt, for example, our beliefs about the history of this holiday of freedom, don't rest on historical evidence.
That's for sure.
We don't look for, oh, there's this site in the desert where we discovered XYZ. That's like, if it conveniently fits the accepted version of our story, fine. If it doesn't, we ignore it.
We need to continue this conversation next week, Tom, as we move closer to Passover. But fascinating stuff. Thank you. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Hello. Hello, David. Listen, David, your mother and I have decided, after 40 years, we are getting a divorce. No, David, you can't talk us out of it. I've had enough of this woman. All day long, kvetching and nagging for 4 decades. Enough is enough. You'll be right here? What are you talking? You have a family of your own now, a wife, 3 kids. You can't just fly around the country any old time. All right, bring them all. But I promise you, it wouldn't help. Okay, have it your way. We'll see you Thursday. Safe travels. Okay, Sadie, they're all coming for Seder. But what are we going to do to get them here for Rosh Hashanah? That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Two Jewish. Just for you. You should live and be well. And hope everybody comes for Pesach. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Mitzorah in the book of Leviticus, focusing on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world. It's true, leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular by using quarantine to isolate its victims. But exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length in a Sabbath service may not be a spiritually meaningful experience, no matter how relevant it seems from the last 2 years. So the rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago and came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word mitzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. Their interpretation was based on evidence from the Torah itself. Moses' hand became leprous when he expressed doubt about the willingness of the people to believe in his mission. Miriam was struck by leprosy when she spoke against Moses. The leper was a person who, therefore, spoke badly about others. Evil speech, Lashon Hara, and its even darker partner, Motzi Shem Ra, slander, were considered by the sages to be among the worst sins of all. What needed to be eliminated from society was not just the biological illness of leprosy, but these terrible infections of slander and gossip.
The ways in which we employ language lead to many of the worst problems in society. Lashon Hara, Maimonides taught, is not only an epidemic disease, but a multiple murderer killing three people. The one who shares gossip, the one who hears gossip, and the one, of course, who is the subject of gossip. According to Jewish law, even gossip with a kernel of truth in it is Lashon Hara, and inherently wrong, and causes intense societal damage. Some authorities, such as the great rabbi known as the Chofetz Chaim, go so far as to say that even gossiping about the truth is morally heinous. There's an interesting parallel in our own law code in the United States. There's a legal concept in American jurisprudence called the fruit of the poisoned tree, which rules out the use of evidence collected improperly. Any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and thus not legally admissible. So it is with Metzora and all other forms of Lashon Hara, evil speech, whether the gossip has truth in it or not. It is derived from a fundamentally corrupt source. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. The rabbis teach that if you commit no slander, your own life will be clean of moral illness. By purifying your speech of words that are damaging to others, you can find your way clear to living a better, holier life. Our portion this week even delineates forms of Metzora that affect the very houses in which we live, called Metzora Ad Bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. It's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but organizations, synagogues, and communities in which holiness flourishes, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated. May we each do our part now and always to remove Metzora, personal impurities of speech, from our lives, our institutions, and our community. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Alan Winter, co-author of a dramatic novel set in Israel, explains the challenges and rewards of spy novelizing today. Find out all about that and where else the book goes in just a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Five people were murdered when a Palestinian terrorist opened fire on pedestrians in multiple municipalities near Tel Aviv last week. The attack took place where B'nai Brak, a largely Haredi, ultra-Orthodox municipality, runs into Ramat Gan, a Tel Aviv suburb. The attacker shot people as he traveled down a thoroughfare. There were casualties in both towns. The murderer was a Palestinian from the West Bank. The police killed him. Reports say the gunman, in some instances, got off his motorcycle and shot at people, shouting at them to stop in Hebrew. There have been two other deadly attacks in Israel over the past week, killing six. The Tel Aviv attacks brought the week's total of fatalities in these Palestinian terrorist murders to 11. The other attacks were allegedly carried out by Israeli Arab citizens who identify with the Islamic State. The most recent murderous attack, 2 days earlier than the last one, was reportedly spurred by the historic summit this week, in which Israel hosted four Arab foreign ministers for the first time. These attacks also come in the lead-up to Ramadan, the Muslim holiday when tensions are often heightened around prayer spaces in Jerusalem. Israeli police and Muslim worshippers clashed for weeks at this same time last year. Well, they often do. Last week, the U.S. Senate, in a voice vote, unanimously confirmed Deborah Lipstadt, Holocaust scholar who has endured delays and a contentious hearing in her nomination to become the anti-Semitism monitor. The actual vote took just a few seconds. None of Deborah Lipstadt's Republican critics demanded debate or a head count, actions that might further have delayed her nomination. That was in sharp contrast to the procedural maneuvers Republicans used for months to delay her confirmation as anti-Semitism monitor. Senator Joel Ossoff introduced the motion to nominate Deborah Lipstadt in part because he represents Georgia. Lipstadt teaches at Emory University in Atlanta, but Ossoff also noted his Jewish roots in his speech. It was U.S. forces who liberated Dachau and Buchenwald, and Annie and Israel, my great-grandparents, and they got out of Europe, Ossoff said. Many of my family did not. and they perished in the Holocaust. This isn't ancient history. This is recent history. Right now, as we speak, the scourge of anti-Semitism is rising again in this country and around the world. If we mean the words never again, then at long last, let's confirm Deborah Lipstadt to fight anti-Semitism on behalf of the United States. Lipstadt is the first anti-Semitism monitor to have the position of ambassador under a law passed by Congress in 2020 that enhances her status overseas when she makes representations to foreign governments and allows her more direct access to the Secretary of State and the President should she come across situations that she believes require executive action. The anti-Semitism monitor position having the rank of ambassador means that the role requires Senate confirmation. Lipstadt's past criticisms of former President Donald Trump, and particularly of Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson, led to delays in a contentious hearing in February. Only two Republicans on the Foreign Relations Committee joined the Democrats earlier this week in advancing the nomination. A broad array of Jewish and pro-Israel groups advocated on behalf of Deborah Lipstadt, including groups like the Orthodox Union and Christians United for Israel, CUFI, which maintain close ties with Republicans. Deborah Lipstadt, a past guest of Too Jewish, is now 75 years old. She has been, for years, the go-to expert for the media and legislators on many Holocaust issues, particularly on how the genocide's meaning should be understood in the 21st century. In other news, a historic meeting between Israeli leaders and their counterparts from Egypt, Morocco, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates took place in the Negev last week. It is going to become a regular event, they said, rotating among the participating countries. Leaders of the countries and Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, announced the regular meetings about regional security during a joint press conference at the conclusion of this first convening of Arab and Israeli leaders in the same place. This meeting is the first of its kind, but not the last, said Israel's Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. Last night, we decided to make the Negev summit a permanent forum. The convening and the announcements are significant because they indicate that the Abraham Accords peace agreement signed in 2020 that normalized relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco are more than symbolic. The countries at the summit discussed growing ties with Israel and their desire to create a united front in opposition to Iran in the region. This meeting took place in Sde Boker, a city in Israel's southern Negev region, and that was the home and burial place of Israel's founding Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion. News from the summit was interrupted by the Palestinian terror attack in Hadera, which resulted in the deaths of two police officers. In his remarks, Lapid said those participating in the meeting would not be intimidated by terror. Bahraini Foreign Minister Abu Latif bin Rashid al-Zayani began his speech by condemning the terror attack. I'd like to start by condemning the terrorist attack which took place last night, claiming the lives of two border policemen. I would like to convey our condolences to the bereaved families and reaffirm our firm stance against terrorism in all its forms. In his remarks, Moroccan Foreign Affairs Minister Nasser Bourita called the summit the best response to the attack in Hadera. Several of the diplomats, including Antony Blinken, spoke about the Palestinian people and called for continued work towards a two-state solution. And Valentina Veretska, a Ukrainian athlete who fled with her daughter when Russia attacked their country, won the women's race in the Jerusalem Marathon last week. Veretska completed the grueling marathon in the very hilly city. I run a lot in Jerusalem, lots of difficult hills. She completed the marathon in 2 hours, 45 minutes, 54 seconds, and draped herself in the Ukrainian and Israeli flags after crossing the finish line. The 31-year-old applied to run the marathon before the war. She previously won a women's marathon this year in Tirana, Albania. The war Russia launched February 24th, invading Ukraine, sent this athlete and her daughter to Poland. Her husband stayed in Ukraine to fight. Israel has now taken in close to 18,000 Ukrainian refugees since the conflict began. Israel's sports ministry said it will take in about 100 athletes. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews round the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona. Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Alan Winter is the author of Sins of the Fathers, co-author with Herbert Stern. Sins of the Fathers is a sequel to their earlier novel, Wolf, which is about Hitler's rise to power. And it tells the dramatic story about his, let's have you tell it. Tell us, having covered the early facts about Hitler, who was a painter, who was supposedly a sensitive guy, tell us how you came to start Sins of the Fathers. And what was most interesting about writing it?
You mean Sins of the Fathers or Wolf, or how Wolf turned into Sins of the Fathers?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of both.
All right. Well, I think it's important to understand that when we began this 5 years ago, the premise was, who knows that Adolf Hitler was in a mental institution at the end of the Great War? And most historians completely skipped over that. If you read all current books, then we've looked at the last 25 years of all the books on Hitler. They do not mention that he was in a mental ward. Historically, everybody knows that he was in a gas attack. But what they don't realize is that he was treated by a psychiatrist, not an ophthalmologist. And from there, that took us on a journey to peel away the layers of why he was in the hospital, that he was viewed as having hysterical blindness, psychotic, and he had a mental illness, which was hidden from the German people. But not only hidden from the German people, the historians hid that in most of their books from the last 50 or 75 years, even though the information was available. So the journey that we took was, what truths were there that the historians weren't dealing with? And one of the uncomfortable things, and I need to say this, is that Hitler put his pants on one leg at a time like everybody else. And we humanized him only to the point where he did have human emotions. He loved women. Women loved him. He was a loyal friend. And all of this is not found in the textbooks. And this is how our stories evolved. And then from there, we started to look very clearly, I guess, at how he came to power, how he treated the Jews, where was the anti-Semitism, did he really want to kill the Jews from day one, and could they have been saved? And that's really what Sins of the Father is about, the latter.
There was an interesting film called Max that was made a few years back, which kind of set up a fascinating premise that part of Hitler's anti-Semitism was sort of his frustrated inability to make it as an avant-garde artist. People have lots of theories about it. Where, in your view, did this horrifying, profound, and devastating anti-Semitism come from within Hitler?
I don't think it came from the art world or anything like that. People attributed it to when he was in Vienna as a young man, or that he was rejected by the Art Institute. I don't think it was any of that. He also loved his mother's doctor, who was Jewish, Dr. Bloch. His artwork was sold by Jewish art dealers. So I don't think it was then. I think what happened was he drank the Kool-Aid, if you will, if I can use that cliche, at the end of the war and realizing that Germany lost, that he, there was this whole Aryanism, which was not his original idea. He rubbed shoulders with Jeffrey Feder and other people in something called the Tool Society. And they believed in the untainted blood of Aryans and anybody who tainted the blood. And that's one of the reasons the German society was going downhill, should be removed from Germany. And it was very easy to pick on the Jews. So that's partially one of the reasons. The other reason is that not only Germany, but most of Western Europe was very afraid of Bolshevism and the communists coming westward toward them. And they would say that a lot of the early communists were Jews. And the reports about the communists were written up in newspapers owned by Jews. And books were written by Jews. And it went on and on and on. So it was very easy to pick a scapegoat. And it became so virulent that he believed that the Jews were not even a human species.
You know, you've now spent, as you said, like 5 years researching and writing about Hitler in novel form. Does that change you? It just seems like something that would be really difficult to do to me.
Changed us in a couple of ways. One is that, candidly, we don't believe the history that was written in the way that it was written. Hitler did, let me say it this way. It's not that I'm affected by Hitler more or the Holocaust more, but what I'm affected by is the lack of action by the rest of the world. If I was affected one way, and my co-author, I think, would say the same thing, Herb Stern, we are stunned how little the rest of the world did, knowing that the Jews were under fire, that there were refugees, which is similar to what's going on today in Europe, roaming. They didn't have a place. And the problem with the Jews is that not only did Germany not want them, and then when they took over Austria, no country wanted them either. And what they did, and this includes England and America and France, is that they validated in Hitler's mind that he was right in wanting to rid Germany of Jews. That's the thing that I am struck by the most, that no Western civilized country helped.
Do you, having gone through this process and I guess covered the Hitlerian rise to power, its concentration of power, the turn towards virulent anti-Semitism. I mean, it's anti-Semitic from the beginning, but becomes obviously genocidal. You stop the book before it gets really horrific. Are you going to continue?
I don't know that we'll continue together. I might. We have to discuss that. Going forward, we thought about it as a trilogy, but I may write it in a different way. You know, candidly, I think that's what's going to happen. But I think that if we stop here, we have made a contribution to the historiography of this period. What is very clear is Hitler did not want to kill the Jews in the beginning. And I don't know if you have time to discuss this or want to even go in this direction.
Yes, please.
But he never, ever set out to kill the Jews. That's not what happened, not in the early years of Mein Kampf in the 20s, not when he took over as chancellor in 33. His was a problem of, we had 525,000 Jews in Germany. He made oppressive laws to get rid of them because he truly believed he had to get rid of them. And about 100,000 left over time. So we still had 400,000. Now he takes over in the Anschluss in 38 of Austria, and he gains another 175,000. Then he's going to gain another 175,000-200,000 in Czechoslovakia. And then the war starts, and he gets 3 million. He ghettoizes them. If you think about what he did, he didn't kill any Jews prior to World War II. He didn't send them to the concentration camps because they were Jews. None of that happened. It only happened that every time he took over another country, he ended up with more Jews. It was, and I hate to sound crass when I say this, it became a warehousing problem. You know, there was no room in the ghettos, and as they marched toward Moscow and Russia in, you know, in the end of 41, 42, there was no other place to put them. That's when the final solution came about. And he excoriated in January of 39, and this is how our author's notes and sins, and it's in the book itself, a speech where he excoriates the people who went to the Evian conference in July of 38 that Franklin Roosevelt convened. There were 32 countries there. And not one. And the whole idea was to deal with the refugees from Europe, which is a another way of saying Jewish refugees, but they didn't want to make it a Jewish problem. That was an issue that FDR had. He couldn't make the problems in Europe Jewish. America would not go and save the Jews. They would fight for democracy, freedom. They're not going to fight for the Jews. So it became a refugee problem. And the problem with that is that they had the Evian conference and not one country changed their quotas of immigration. So no one wanted them, and Hitler was backed into this solution. Now, it's an irrational solution, and that's where his insanity is. He allowed it to happen.
One of the really fascinating things that emerges in this novel, Sins of the Fathers, is, I mean, Hitler has an eidetic memory. Hitler is a competent leader. Obviously, you would think to create that great war machine and lead it in its terrible course, you would have to have that capability. But I'm not sure he's thinking very strategically much of the time. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree with you. That was his failing. He didn't listen to his military advisors. He thought he was smarter. And every time that he said, I'm going to do this, and they counseled him, please don't go into the Rhine Valley. Don't take the Saar people back. Don't go into the Anschluss. We're going to go to war with France and England and Russia. And he proved them wrong because not a shot was fired. And he reclaimed all these lands that were taken away as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. So he egotistically, maniacally, narcissistically believed he was better than his generals. And if you think about it from a realistic point of view, you have a corporal running the entire military apparatus of the greatest war machine in the world at the time. He had the logistics of a corporal. He didn't understand what he was doing. So he made mistake after mistake militarily against his advisors. Council, and that's why he lost everything. That's, you know, and that's historically, you know, the historians will back that up.
One more question about the historical impact of this. Why do we want to make him into such a incredibly evil person, which he was, but why is it important that every aspect of him be turned into something terribly evil? In today's world, why is that a big part of it?
Well, Robert, that's a great question. The answer is simple, I think. How can you normalize someone who sanctioned the death of not only 6 million Jews, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of gypsies and Jehovah's Witnesses and homosexuals and liberals and
Any political resistors, you know,
anybody.
Anyone.
He got rid of everybody. And so you make him a caricature that he did things that were not humane and he did them demonically. And how can you then say that he loved women, he loved children, he loved dogs? And so the historians, up until I think our book, quite honestly, and there were books before that in 1976 and earlier. Authors by John Tolan and Ralph Binion, they described him accurately. And then the last generation, the last almost 50 years of authors, didn't know how to deal with it, or they didn't want to be accused of writing a good word about Hitler. And so the myth of him being a gargoyle, a caricature, was perpetuated, has been perpetuated up until this day. And that was one of the reasons we wrote these books, was not to, was to demythicize him, to make him human, but not make him better, because believe me, he wasn't better. And that's not our mission, our goal.
No, I mean, I think it's important to understand. I guess I would add one thing, which is if you make him a caricature, then you believe nobody could, it can never happen again. This is the worst human being in history. If you understand what the appeal was, then maybe you understand how that's not a one-off in human history. People like this can come along again.
Well, that was why we wrote this. You're right. And there's a very thin line between what people tolerated in Germany in 1920s and 30s and early 40s and the rest of the world. And this is for a much longer conversation, not now.
Yeah.
But you know, could Americans rally behind someone like him and keep their heads down and don't make a fuss and allow that kind of dehumanization to occur to their fellow citizens as long as it didn't occur to them? And I would argue that it's possible. It's
yeah.
possible. And that's one of the reasons why we wrote the book again. Another reason.
I want to thank Alan Winter for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Sins of the Fathers. It's a great reading novel. Where can people go to find out more about you, find out more about the book?
Well, my website is my name, Alan, A-L-A-N, Winter, W-I-N-T-E-R.com. So that's simple. All my books are listed there. There are excerpts of Sins of the Father there, and all the books are available at ahead of time at Barnes & Noble. They can be pre-ordered. Both Wolf is coming out in paperback in January, and Sins is coming out in February, and they're both available. All the books are available now.
Alan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Rabbi Zach Kamenetz, founder of the organization Shefa that explores the use of psychedelics and Judaism. Fascinating subject and an interesting, well, coalescence. Don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, and of course, all of that also available on Facebook. And sign up now for our wonderful second night Pesach Seder at Beit Simcha, which will include donations for Ukrainian Jewish relief. Go to Beit Simcha Tucson.org. That's Saturday night, April 16th. More information, sign up to affirm freedom with an outstretched hand. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music. The Seder is, of course, less than 2 weeks away now. The song is When You Believe by past guest of Too Jewish, composer and lyricist Stephen Schwartz. My friends, may you have a healthy week, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of peace.
Many nights we've prayed with no proof anyone could hear. In our hearts a hopeful song we barely understood. Now we are not afraid, although we know there's much to fear. We were moving mountains long before we knew.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.